Hello and welcome to Crime Theories Off the Record, the podcast series where I talk about my interpretation of crime theories. This is your host, Karen. Today, I'll discuss our second conflict theorist, Dr. William J. Chambliss, also known as Bill, who advanced conflict theory through his studies of organized crime figures, opium farmers, gang members, pirates, and corrupt politicians. Chambliss demonstrated that conflict between social classes is the basic social process in a capitalist society, and the key to understanding criminal justice process and structures. Off the record, isn't it wild when you can say that someone researched pirates? But as I burst your bubble, this does not mean that he studied your Pirates of the Caribbean, but a state's complicity in piracy, such as smuggling, assassinations, criminal conspiracies, the concept of acting as an accessory before or after the fact and violating laws that limit their activities. So if you think about it, Bill was making true crime mainstream before we all started listening to it before bedtime and was a true conspiracy theorist. However, Chambliss's primary contribution to conflict theory was to advance knowledge about who make laws, how and why they are enforced, and the relationship between those who have power and those who do not. In early work on power roles, in determining what people law enforcement targets. But before I jump into this, I would like to remind everyone that I am not an expert in every aspect of my field, but have researched the topic. Finishing his graduate work in 1962, same as Dr. Turk, Dr. Chambliss had become interested in the development of criminal law, specifically in sociologically relevant analysis of the relationship between particular laws and the social setting in which these laws emerge, are interpreted, and take form. Chambliss, 1987, also had been candid about the relationship between his theoretical perspective and life experiences. Off the record, I remember that during my graduate career, I read somewhere that after he graduated from UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, he hitchhiked across the country again to see his father. For context, hitchhiking wasn't as unusual as it is now, but it still has its dangers. Just a year after the Vietnam War started, he was drafted into the army and sent to Korea with the Counterintelligence Corps, CAC. The story says that Bill Chambliss learned much more about crime during this period, American and Korean soldiers raping, stealing, assaulting, and intimidating and terrorizing Koreans. Because they had the power, nothing was done about it. So, Watson Thomas Sherlock, how could crime be understood from that paradigm? While at UCLA, Chambliss developed a mentoring relationship with American sociologist Donald Creasy. After military service, he followed Creasy's advice to pursue his doctorate in sociology at his alma mater, where he could study with Edwin Sutherland and Albert Cohen. He went on to teach at the University of Washington and then to undertake postdoctoral studies at the University of Wisconsin. Off the record, if this story sounds a bit familiar, it's because it is. Both Turk and Quinney, the first and or third contemporary criminological conflict theorists, completed their graduate work at the University of Wisconsin in the same year that Chambliss was completing his at Indiana. And second, Dr. Turk himself joined the faculty at Indiana after completion of his graduate work at Wisconsin. Like Turk, Chambliss was impressed by the relativity of crime and how the criminal label seemed to be the product of social conflict. But whereas a formal Simmelian approach influenced Turk's work, Chambliss was initially inspired less by the older European tradition of conflict theory than by the American tradition of legal realism. The pioneering work of the American legal scholar Jerome Hall, and the results of his empirical research. Chambliss, 1964, studied the development of vagrancy laws in England, concluding that these laws could be traced to vested interest. For those who might or might not remember, Chambliss, 1973, also studied the impact of differential labeling and legal response to two sets of delinquent youths, the upper middle class and the lower class. Again, he showed how the law in action diminished the life chances of poor kids by defining and policing them as troublemakers while failing to intervene with the pre-college kids because they were quote-unquote good boys, only quote-unquote, sowing their oats. As mentioned in Turk's episode, in 1969, Turk published Criminality and the Legal Order, as Shamblish, 1969, published Crime and the Legal Process, an edited volume consisting of actual empirical research studies of the legal system, tying it together with his theoretical framework. This was followed by a more elaborate presentation, Law, Order, and Power, in collaboration with Robert T. Seidman, a law professor at the University of Wisconsin. Shamblish, 1969, identified his position as representing an interest group perspective rather than a value expression perspective, a distinction that he compared with that seen in the debate in social science theory between the conflict and functional theorists. His approach was significantly influenced by the American School of Legal Realism, which concerned itself with the distinction between the law in the books and the law in action. It insisted that the study of the law must complement the study of abstract legal theory as it works itself out in actual practice. Off the record, let's take a road down memory lane and note that although in our first couple of episodes I had focused on the classical school of criminology, now our attention is to the law in action representing the influence of positivism in legal studies. Shamblish hoped to develop a theory of law in action, a theory based on empirical research. Shamblish and Seidman, 1971, allude to an almost Durkheimian theme, asserting that the first variable in our theoretical model is the relative complexity of the society. They went on to insist that the complexity which comes with technological development and necessitates more complicated, differentiated, and sophisticated social roles actually operates to put people at odds with another, thereby requiring formal institutions designed to sanction what some consider to be norm violations. This argument was reminiscent of Dahrendorf's, with the significant difference being that formal sanctioning institutions were regarded not as inherently necessary to society, but rather as contemporary necessity resulting from increasing social complexity. Their conflict perspective led them to a theory of legal development almost precisely opposite to that expound in Durkheim's control theory approach, which maintained that increased societal complexity tended to lead the society from an emphasis on repressive law to a focus on restorative law. For this next part, I will be reading an excerpt from which Shamblish and Seidman, 1971, argued. We may formulate, therefore, the following proposition. The lower the level of complexity of a society, the more emphasis will be placed in the dispute settling process upon reconciliation. The more complex the society, the more emphasis will be placed on role enforcement. Shamblish and Seidman, 1971, began by arguing that increasing social complexity itself tended to call for sanctioning institutions designed to keep order among conflicting interests. They maintained that this sanctioning process could become even more pronounced to the degree that the social complexity became a matter of social stratification, with some groups having more wealth and power than others. And because I have been discussing Marxist criminology, here is something of a Marxian theme. However, Shamblish and Seidman stopped short of a clear-cut Marxian position that traced the most severe problems of social stratification to polarization produced by capitalism. Shamblish and Seidman, 1971, also stressed the significance of the fact that the developing sanctions tended to be enforced through bureaucratic organizations. In their view, the basis of the sanctioning could be organized in the interest of the dominant groups. Still, the actual application of the sanctions tended to come through bureaucracies with their interest. In this sense, the law in action might be expected to reflect a combination of the interests of the powerful and the interests of the bureaucratic organizations created to enforce the rules. Because the essence of Shamblish's theory was aimed at explaining the law in action, in contemporary complex industrial societies, we concentrate on the second and the third variables in the theory of the law in action, social stratification and bureaucracy. In Crime and the Legal Process, Shamblish, 1969, stressed that the single most important characteristic of contemporary Anglo-American society influential in shaping the legal order has been the emerging domination of the middle classes, along with the attempt by members of the middle class to impose their standards and their view of proper behavior on people whose values differ. In this view, the middle class was coming to represent conventional morality, but Shamblish emphasize that behind the values lay self-interest. In Law, Order, and Power, Chambliss and Sitman, 1971, set forth five fundamental propositions concerning the relationship between social stratification and the law. Beginning with the proposition that 1. The conditions of one's life affect one's values and norms, they then asserted that two complex societies are composed of groups with widely different life conditions and that 3. Complex societies are composed of highly disparate and conflicting set of norms. As for the relationship between these conflicting norms and the law itself, they maintain that 4. The probability of a given group having its particular normative system embodied in law is not distributed equally, but is closely related to that group's political and economic position. These propositions taken together led the authors to the final proposition that 5. The higher a group's political or economic position, the greater the probability that its view will be reflected in the laws. Most of Chambliss and Sitman's theoretical explanation for the law in action focus on the argument that although the law represents the values and interests of the more powerful elements in the stratification system of complex societies, it is specifically created and enforced by bureaucratic organizations with their agendas. In Crime and the Legal Process, Chambliss, 1969, insisted that the most salient characteristic of organizational behavior is that the ongoing policies and activities are those designed to maximize rewards and minimize strains for the organization. Furthermore, this general principle is reflected in the fact that in the administration of the criminal law, those persons are arrested, tried, and sentenced who can offer the fewest rewards for non-enforcement of the laws and who can be processed without creating any undue strain for the organizations, which compromise the legal system. In Chambliss's view, the criminal justice bureaucracies tended to treat those of a lower social class position more harshly for the same offenses committed by the middle class and upper class people, because lower social class people had little to offer in return for leniency and were in no position to fight the system. Sounds a little too familiar. In addition, Chambliss insisted these bureaucracies tended to ignore or deal leniently with the same offenses when committed by those higher in the stratification hierarchy. The process by which the goals of bureaucratic efficiency and avoidance of trouble displaced the official goal of impartial law enforcement has been termed goal displacement or goal substitution. Chambliss and Sitman, 1971, went into much more detail concerning the symbiosis involving organized crime, presenting evidence in support of the proposition that from the standpoint of the sociology of legal systems, the most important aspect of the widespread presence of organized crime is that such organizations are impossible without the help of the legal system. Chambliss, 1969, used this argument to explain some characteristics of the Anglo-American legal system that seems somewhat illogical. As he pointed out, ironically, most of the criminal legal effort is devoted to processing and sanctioning those persons least likely to be deterred by legal sanctions. He cited the use of harsh punishments against drug addicts and capital punishment against murderers as examples of severe sanctioning in exactly those cases where it was a little deterrent effect. By contrast, he cited the reluctance to impose stiff sanctions against white-collar criminals and professional criminals as examples of allowing precisely those criminals who do tend to be deterred by sanctions to escape them. According to his argument, such a policy goes directly against the formal logic of deterrence. Still, it fits perfectly the bureaucratic logic of demonstrating effectiveness by the harsh treatment of the powerless, while avoiding the organizational strains that would follow from taking on the powerful. And Watson to my Sherlock, we can see this as we look at how marijuana was decriminalized in certain states. We saw how harsh punishments were issued to a disproportionate group of people of color. According to Chambliss, a bureaucratic organization might be expected to take the path of least resistance, especially in contexts where the members have little motivation to resist the easy way out, or they have a great deal of discretion in how they actually will behave. Adherence to the official goals is not enforced, thus the failure of the legal system to exploit the potential source of offenses that the middle and upper class violators offer derives instead from the very rational choice on the part of the legal system to pursue those violators who the community will reward them for pursuing and for ignoring those violators who have the capability of causing trouble for the agency. Whew, that was a lot. Now, let's take a moment to look at one of our main characters, the police. Chambliss and Sittman, 1971, presented evidence leading to the conclusion that the police, as a bureaucracy, quote-unquote, act illegally, breaching the norms of due process at every point. In committing brutality in their searches and seizures, in arrests and interrogations, this illegality takes place not because the police are evil, but rather because they are not committed to due process in the first place. They have enormous discretion. There is little enforcement of due process norms by the public or other criminal justice system agencies. As for prosecution following an arrest, Chambliss and Sittman concluded that how favorable a bargain one can strike with the prosecutor in the pretrial confrontations is a direct function of how politically and economically powerful the defendant is. The alleged safeguards provided by the right to trial by jury were taken to be essentially a matter of myth because of the built-in hazards of the jury trial, which exert the greatest pressure on accused persons to plead guilty, leading the powerless to surrender this so-called right in 9 out of 10 cases. Finally, Chambliss and Sittman attempted to establish the validity of the proposition that the tendency and necessity to bureaucratize is far and away the single most important variable in determining the actual day-to-day functioning of the legal system. By demonstrating how, even in sentencing, institutionalized patterns of discrimination against the poor are inevitable. Off the record, regardless of your biases towards the police, Chambliss and Sittman are alluding to racial profiling and police deviance. I have briefly mentioned or alluded to racial profiling in past episodes, but never really gone into depth, as it tends to trigger some of my interactions with people in authority. And even though I have mostly good experiences thanks to my white passing privilege, it is not always the case. White passing privilege is the additional privilege some people of color, like myself, are afforded when their features such as skin color or hair texture cause them to be mistaken as white. This privilege is really entrenched in colorism. Alice Walker defines it in her book In Search of Our Mother's Gardens as the prejudicial or preferential treatment of same race people based solely on their color. Racial profiling is a discriminatory practice by law enforcement officials of targeting individuals for suspicion of crime based on a person's ethnicity, religion, or nationality rather than on a person's suspicion or available evidence. It also involves discrimination against minority populations and often builds up a negative stereotypes of certain groups. But back to the theory. For several years before Chambliss's original presentation of his theoretical framework, he had studied the relationship between professional crime and the legal system in a large American city. His experience conducting this study influenced his thinking, especially concerning the impact of bureaucracy on the legal system, pointing out that although at first glance it would appear that the professional criminal, be the thief, gambler, prostitute, or hustler, would have little to offer the law enforcement agencies. He noted that there appear in practice to be a situation of symbiosis or mutual dependence there. He argued that because law enforcement agencies depend on professional criminals for inside information, that makes their jobs easier. They tend to get help from these offenders rather than enforcing the law against them. Off the record, if you thought of this symbiotic relationship and thought of a snitch, or in the case of law enforcement, a confidential informant, then you are on the right track. And for those who are very well versed on their mafia's history, then you might be aware of Joseph the Ear Massino and many others, but I will not touch deeper on the topic because I actually am scared of that. As for Durkheim's control theory argument that law contributed to social solidarity, Chambliss 1969 concluded that the imposition of legal sanctions is likely to increase community solidarity only when the emergent morality also serves others' interests of persons in positions of power in the community. Although admitting that the law might occasionally contribute to social solidarity, he instead stressed how the law in action splintered the community by labeling and excluding certain of its powerless members, and how policies such as the death penalty may play an extremely important role in the general attitude toward the legitimacy of the use of extreme violence to settle disputes. For some context, it is important to know that by the mid-1970s, political events in general and developments in social theory in particular seem to have combined to produce a significant shift in Chambliss's perspective. The social changes of the 1960s, which had influenced both Turk and Chambliss, had at the same time led many important social theorists to return to the Marxist tradition that had lain dormant during the war years of the 1940s and the second Red Scare of the 1950s. These Marxist theorists traced the problem of racial discrimination and the war in Vietnam directly to the economic interest of capitalists. They argued that the counterculture response to the American Dream was politically naive and could be crushed unless its adherents developed a revolutionary socialist mentality. The end of the 1960s saw the emergence of a political backlash that threatened not only to block the prospects for reform implicit in Chambliss's critic of the law in action, but also to turn the clock back to restore the social and political climate of the 1950s. Chambliss concluded that the problems lay deeper than he had suspected, that the Marxists had come closer to the truth, and that his analysis must be turned in a Marxist direction. Chambliss's 1975 shift was reflected in 9 specific propositions concerning the content and operation of criminal law. He now asserted that 1. Acts are defined as criminal because it is in the interest of the ruling class to so define them. That 2. Members of the ruling class will be able to violate the laws with impunity, while members of the subject class will be punished. And that 3. As capitalist societies industrialize and the gap between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat widens, penal law will expand in an effort to coerce the proletariat into submission. As for the consequences of crime for society, he maintained that 4. Crime reduces surplus labor to creating employment not only for the criminals but for law enforcers, welfare workers, professors of criminology, and a horde of people who live off the fact that crime exists. And that 5th, crime diverts the lower classes' attention from the exploitation they experience and directs it toward other members of their class rather than toward the capitalist class or the economic system. And that 6th, crime is a reality which exists only as it is created by those in society whose interests are served by its presence. Summarizing his position and its implications, Chambliss 1975 argued that 7. Criminal and non-criminal behavior stems from people acting rationally in ways that are compatible with their class position, a reaction to the life conditions of a person's social class. That 8. Crime varies from society to society depending on the political and economic structures of society. And that 9. Socialist countries should have much lower rates of crime because the less intense class struggle should reduce the forces leading to and the functions of crime. The similarity to Bonger's position was clear, and the using terms such as the bourgeoisie, proletariat, exploitation, and class struggle stressed the shift to a more Marxist formulation, focusing on capitalism as the problem and socialism as a way of dealing with it. Wow, that was a lot. So feel free to review, pause, replay this episode as many times as needed. I will be covering our last conflict theorist, Richard Quiney, next week. Thank you for listening and choosing this podcast. This episode is brought to you by Anchor. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Spotify or whatever platform you're listening from. And don't forget to tune in for the next episode. Off the record, if you need help visualizing these theories, go check us up on Instagram at ct.offtherecord.